This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In its final 2 days of public hearings, the 9/11 Commission examined two of the most contentious aspects of the attacks. Yesterday, the commission concluded that Saddam Hussein's Iraq played no part in the plot and then added that, despite some contacts between al-Qaeda and Iraq, there was no collaborative relationship. Today, President Bush asserted again that such a relationship did exist. We'll hear from both sides of that argument later in the program. But first, today's dramatic reconstruction of the response to the attacks that Tuesday morning. The 9/11 Commission's staff report concludes that both the Federal Aviation Administration and the North American Aerospace Defense Command had not prepared or trained for suicide attacks. It documents confusion and mistakes, yes, but some remarkable improvisation, too, all amid widespread inability to comprehend the enormity of what was happening. NPR National Security Correspondent Mary Louise Kelly joins us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in today.
Good to be here, Neil.
Let's go through this reconstruction, if you would, and let's begin with what happened, regarding the first plane to be hijacked, American Airlines Flight 11, out of Logan Airport.
Well, here's what we know that we learned from the commission report this morning. That plane started taxiing down the runway at 8 o'clock the morning of September 11th. At 8:21, the flight turned off its transponder. That's the device through which air traffic controllers are able to monitor where it is, its altitude, what direction it's heading. That was the first indication that something might be wrong, and the controller told his supervisor he thought there was something seriously wrong with that plane. But at that point, no one suspected a hijacking, and they did not suspect that until 3 minutes later, 8:24, when they were able to hear a radio transmission from the plane.
A reminder that they had not had a hijacking in this country since 1993, so this was a highly unusual event. And here's the tape which the commission's report says this is believed to be the voice of the lead hijacker, Mohammed Atta.
We have some planes, just stay quiet and you'll be okay. We're returning to the airport.
And at that point, they knew something was going on. There are protocols to deal with all of this. They're written down in case there's a hijacking. People do train on those, but they were anticipating a hijacking of the type that had always gone on before.
Right, where someone might try to take the plane, land it somewhere, demand some money, demand something in return for the passengers. Exactly. They knew something was going on. That transmission, hard to understand even now, knowing everything that we know. The controller trying to monitor it couldn't quite understand it. He sent it up to a colleague and said, listen back to that tape. What did he say? What did he say? I can't quite tell. Something's wrong, but I don't know what it is. They started passing up the chain of the command and trying to identify what was happening.
And one of the staff report goes on to detail how various agencies and then the military received and communicated the information. And one of the things we learned was that the military's first indication that a plane had been hijacked came at 8:37 when the Boston Center's Federal Aviation Administration Center, it's actually in New Hampshire, but that's what it's called, contacted the Northeast Air Defense Sector.
All right, Boston Center, TMU. We have a problem here. We have a hijacked aircraft headed towards New York, and we need you guys to, we need someone to scramble some F-16s or something up there to help us out.
Is this real world or exercise?
No, this is not an exercise, not a test.
Real world or exercise?
I mean, you can hear just how they were struggling to figure out what was going on. As you say, nothing like this had happened in years, and nothing like this, as it turned out to be on September 11th, had ever happened. But it was at that point, right after that alert went out, that the air defense began. F-15 fighters were ordered scrambled at 8:46 from Otis Air Force Base.
And then there is a problem with confusion, because as normal air traffic control systems, as a plane passes from one area to another, it's handed off from center to center, from Boston to Cleveland to Indianapolis, all of which play a role in what's to follow, of course, New York and Washington as well. And even within one organization, the FAA, air traffic controllers were having trouble getting and sharing information. And let's listen to this conversation. Just past 9 o'clock, a manager from the Boston Center FAA, NORAD didn't know that the search for American flight was underway. Let's listen to this tape excerpt.
Are you still there?
Yes, I am.
I'm going to reconfirm with downstairs as far as the tape, but seem to think that the guy said that we have planes. Now, I don't know if it was because it was the accent or if there's more than one, but I'm gonna reconfirm that for you. And I'll get back to you real quick, okay?
Appreciate it.
Yes, what?
Planes, as in plural. Sounds like we're talking to New York, but there's another one aimed at the World Trade Center.
There's another aircraft
The second one just hit the Trade Center.
Okay. Yeah, we got to alert the military real quick on this.
I'm sorry, I introduced the wrong cut of tape there. That was my mistake. That was a conversation between a manager at the Boston Center FAA contacting the New England Center with some information that they had just learned that earlier tape that we heard, the hijacker had said planes, plural, and at this point they begin to realize that the first one had already hit the World Trade Center, and as you hear in the midst of that conversation, they learn that the second aircraft had hit the World Trade Center.
Right, so you hear them trying to get up to speed, desperately trying to figure out who knows what. It was apparently immediately after that conversation, people at the New York Center figured out something was very, very wrong. They declared what's called ATC-0, meaning that aircraft were, from that point, not permitted to go through New York's airspace until further notice. And also, just after this, Boston Center issued a instruction that turned out to be controversial in today's hearing. They asked the Air Command Center to issue a nationwide cockpit security alert, telling all aircraft in the air, watch your cockpit, you know, step up the security, make sure it's locked. And there was a lot of speculation in the testimony this morning about if those instructions had reached, for example, the plane that ended up crashing in Pennsylvania and the pilots had known and been known, don't open your cockpit door for any reason, whether that might have been able to prevent what eventually happened on that plane from happening.
In the meantime, the military was trying to respond to the report documents that in some cases procedures were followed, in other cases procedures were absolutely improvised, and some word never did get through to the military. But one of the big problems all throughout that very confusing morning was confusion over which plane was which. Some fighters were scrambled out of Langley Air Force Base in Virginia, but as we'll hear in this tape excerpt, they think they're about to hit go after American Airlines Flight 11, one of the planes from Boston that was eventually did hit the World Trade Center in New York. They were then told it's still in the air.
Military Boston Center just had a report that American 11 is still in the air and it's on its way towards heading towards Washington.
Okay, American 11 is still in the air?
Yes.
On its way towards Washington?
There was only another aircraft that hit the tower. That's the latest report we have.
Okay.
I'm going to try to confirm an ID for you, but I would assume he's somewhere over either New Jersey or somewhere further south.
Okay, so American 11 isn't the hijack at all then, right?
No, he is a hijack.
American 11 is a hijack?
Yes.
And he's going into Washington?
This could be a third aircraft.
And a third aircraft, there was a third and indeed a fourth, but that wasn't it.
That wasn't the one that they were talking about. So, yes, and not only there was confusion, of course, in terms of trying to track these planes, there was confusion in terms of the fighter jets that were being sent up to try to intercept and maybe do something about it. By the end, you had two sets of F-16s circling around Washington trying to figure out was there anything they could do to prevent what at that point they didn't know, but to prevent anything else awful from happening. But it's not clear that those pilots had the right orders or could have done anything to get there in time.
And the senior counsel of the 9/11 Commission, John Farmer, here reads from the report about the needs. That's the Northeast Aerospace Defense sector. Their response to hearing that Flight 77 was over Washington D.C.
After the 9/36 call to NEADS about the unidentified aircraft a few miles from the White House, the Langley fighters were ordered to Washington, D.C. Controllers at NEAS located an unknown primary radar track, but, quote, it kind of faded, end quote, over Washington. The time was 9:38. The Pentagon had been struck by American 77 at 9:37 and 46 seconds. The Langley fighters were approximately 150 miles away.
So due to mistakes, phantoms, any number of things, it sounds as if the nation's capital was completely naked of protection that day.
I mean, a lot of miscommunication. As we say, there was actually a pair of F-16s sent from Langley Air Force Base in Virginia. They did not believe they were authorized to shoot down an aircraft. Later, another pair of F-16s was sent up over the Capitol from Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland. They did not reach the proper altitude until 10:45 a.m. At that point, that was already 42 minutes after the very last plane had crashed into Pennsylvania. So, yes, there have been assertions all along from NORAD that had that plane not crashed in Pennsylvania, they would have been able to intercept, shoot it down, so do something about it. The commission report this morning said we're not so sure that's the case.
We'll hear from a spokesman for the North American Aerospace Defense Command later in the program. But getting back to this timeline, in all of this, there are meetings being held, hurried conferences, phone calls. At one point, they describe a Secret Service agent with Andrews Air Force Base on one cell phone in one ear and the White House on the other cell phone. phone in the other ear. There were meetings at the FAA, for example, some of which show a good judgment and bad all at the same time. Let's listen to this tape excerpt.
They're pulling Jeff away to go talk about United 93.
Do we want to think about scrambling aircraft?
Oh, God, I don't know.
That's a decision somebody's going to have to make probably in the next 10 minutes.
Everybody just left the room.
Everybody just left the room. We're going to have to decide whether to ask for aircraft to be scrambled sometime in the next 10 minutes. Clearly, a lot of chaos going on.
I have to tell you, when this was played in the hearing room this morning, jaws just dropped. I mean, everyone just gasped to hear this. And the commissioners followed up on it. I believe it was Commissioner Bob Carey asking former and current FAA officials, how on earth, in the middle of this horrific, clearly, even if you didn't know exactly what was going on, you knew it was bad, why was someone who didn't have a clue manning the phone at Air Traffic Command, Control Command Center in Herndon? I mean, it just... It's very easy to second guess in hindsight, but this clearly was an example of communication just not happening as it should have done, and the protocols not being in place.
The conclusion of the staff committee report, indeed the title of their report, is Improvising a Homeland Defense. Yet they also came to the conclusion that though the protocols were wrong, the entire basis on which the protocols had been written were mistaken, did not take into account, obviously, what would happen on the morning of September the 11th. The report found that on the operational level at NEADS and the FAA, operators did as well as they could. Here's the executive director of the commission, Phil Zellico, reading the report.
We do not believe that an accurate understanding of the events of this morning reflects discredit on the operational personnel from NEADS or FAA facilities. The NEADS commanders and floor officers were proactive in seeking information and made the best judgments they could based on the information they received. Individual FAA controllers, facility managers, and command center managers thought outside the box in recommending a nationwide alert, in ground-stopping local traffic, and ultimately in deciding to land all aircraft and executing that unprecedented order flawlessly.
Now, the rest of the report is a discussion about the decisions taken at higher levels than NEADS and the FAA, though the FAA is involved in this as well, and that is at the level of the National Command Authority, the President of the United States, the Vice President, and the Secretary of Defense. And again, I think most Americans remember President Bush was at an elementary school in Florida that morning,
right,
on furthering his education policy, and was actually told while he was on stage that it was a hijack.
That's right. And some 5 to 7 minutes apparently elapsed before he actually got up and left that classroom. That's been the subject of a lot of controversy. The president, according to this commission report, has told commissioners he was most concerned with conveying a sense of stability, of calm, of not showing panic on national television, and that he exited as soon as he could and then quickly sat with advisors to find out what was going on and to figure out he wanted to make a statement before he left that facility. There was also a lot of questioning this morning about where the shoot-down order originated. Of course, everyone wanted to make sure that it originated with the commander-in-chief, with the president, that he was the one, the only one, who could actually give the order to shoot down a passenger aircraft because of the great danger of shooting down the wrong one.
And who's going to be responsible for that decision in either case.
Exactly.
And as you say, eventually it turned out there were two separate pairs of fighter jets circling over Washington, D.C., one from Langley, one from Andrews Air Force Base. They have different instructions and about whether they were authorized to shoot. We'll get into that and more about the command decisions when we return from a short break. Our guest is Mary Louise Kelly, NPR's national security correspondent. We're also going to be taking your phone calls about what you've been hearing today. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. If you have questions about what you've learned about what happened that morning in the response of the authorities in Washington and elsewhere to the attacks of September the 11th. Back after the break, I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the events of the morning of September the 11th, according to the commission that is looking into the attacks. At this morning's hearings, the commission staff presented an extensive reconstruction of what happened that morning and how official America responded to it. If you have a question, again, we would welcome it, 800-989-8255. Mary Louise Kelly, NPR's national security correspondent, is here with us in the studio after going through the FAA's response and some of the things that happened at NORAD. We were talking about the national command level, the president and the vice president. At 10:31, we hear the vice president gave the order allowing fighters to intercept and shoot down planes that had been hijacked. And here's an excerpt of tape, NEAD's personnel responding to the announcement that the order had been issued.
You need to read this. The region commander has declared that we can shoot down aircraft that did not respond to our direction. Copy that?
Copy that, sir.
So if you're trying to divert somebody and he won't divert?
He's saying no.
No? Came over the chat. You got a conflict on that direction?
Right now, no. But
okay. Hey, okay. You read that from the vice president, right? Vice President has cleared.
Vice President has cleared us to intercept track.
You know what they
want? Shoot them down if they do not respond first on RCC.
A couple of things about that, Mary Louise Kelly. As you said earlier, there was a great concern over who had issued the shoot-down order. And according to the commission's report, there were several phone calls between the president and the vice president.
Yes, all between 10 and 10:30 that morning. But there are not exact records of exactly when they spoke or exactly who said what. Vice President Cheney was telling his staff, he was in the bunker underneath the White House, and he was telling people there, I've talked to the president, he's given me the order. We understand that another White House official said, do you want to just call him back and make sure? Let's
Vice
be very,
staff,
very
yes.
sure. Stephen Hadley asked him, let's just double check this. So apparently there was another conversation. Vice President Cheney felt confident after that conversation and issued this order, as we just heard there. However, as we just heard there, it was greeted with a great deal of confusion over the nature and effect of the order. And in fact, NORAD commanders did not say they did not pass this instruction on to the fighter jets that were circling Washington and New York because they were unsure how the pilots would and, in fact, should proceed under this guidance.
And the pilots themselves said they were unaware. They knew something was going on, but were unaware that it involved hijacked civilian airliners. They saw the smoke rising from the Pentagon, and one of the F-15 pilots said he assumed the Russians had somehow sneaked in a cruise missile attack.
Absolutely. And, of course, the irony of all of this, that excerpt that we just heard, was a conversation taking place at 10:31 a.m. The last plane that crashed into the fields of Pennsylvania was at 10:03 a.m., but it speaks again to the uncertainty of that morning that the very senior aviation and White House officials didn't even know it at that point.
And that second pair of jets that took off from Andrews Air Force Base, they did go weapons free. They were authorized to shoot, but this after the conversation with the Secret Service, they were not specifically authorized by the president.
Right.
So confusion all around. This is going to be material that's going to be debated for some time, but there's one name we've not mentioned, and that's that of the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld. Where was he?
Well, he appears to have been out of the picture for much of the morning. He does not emerge and sort of start running things at the Pentagon until about 10:30. He was at the Pentagon that morning. He rushed out and tried to help people. You can understand the instinct if you know your facility has just been attacked. But he was out trying to tend to the injured. At shortly before 10:30, we're told that he went into the command center, was briefed, and just a few moments after that had a conversation with the vice president, Dick Cheney, trying to bring Secretary Rumsfeld up to speed. But again, great confusion and chaos. Vice President Cheney was briefing him and saying, my understanding is that U.S. fighter jets have shot down two of the hijacked planes. Secretary Rumsfeld said, I'm not sure I can confirm that. And of course, it turned out not to be true.
NPR national security correspondent Mary Louise Kelly with us here in 3A. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Neil.
As we've mentioned, much of today's hearings covered the actions of officials with the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA. Joining us now from his home in Fauquier County, Virginia, is Darrell Jenkins, a professor at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach, Florida. And Mr. Jenkins, nice of you to join us today.
Thank you very much, young man.
Are you surprised by the accounts of the FAA's reaction to the 9/11 hijacks on September the 11th?
Oh, not at all. I mean, this seems typical in a panic situation where we really had no planning before this, that we'd had no trials on anything like this. Pretty much within an FAA, a totally unanticipated situation. the fact that they were able to react as quickly as they did in the circumstance and get all the planes down was really kind of short of miraculous.
Yes, the commission's report was emphatic on the point that they improvised all of the responses to this, and some of their improvisations were a little short of brilliant.
Yes, they were, both on the side of the airlines and the FAA. None of them had ever done anything like that. They had almost 5,000 planes in the air I think it was about 10 to 10 when the order went out to bring the planes down. They had pretty much all of them down by noon, and that really is quite an achievement.
Yet we also hear of tremendous communications problems, that the centers in Indianapolis, for example, didn't know what was going on in Boston. Might have helped.
Yeah. I think certainly if something like this would ever happen again, I think we're all indebted to the commission for their study. Because I think what they have done is kind of set the framework for going ahead and dealing with any emergency like this in the future. It's really on its, a lot of this is really quite typical of Washington, where one agency does not talk to another agency. They really don't have a whole lot that they've ever done in terms of practicing talking to each other. The agencies within the city, as you're well aware, fight against each other, especially in August over budgets and stuff like this. So this non-cooperative spirit, which does exist in agencies in Washington, D.C., certainly worked against us.
Not only was there difficulty of communication within the FAA was also having difficulty communicating with outside agencies. When they finally did get up on the Pentagon's conference call, the official who was on the line didn't know what was going on.
Yeah, I remember that morning well because I was working with the press, and I remember the number of conflicting reports that I was receiving from, I mean, all over the place until probably 5 or 6 o'clock in the afternoon.
And to be fair, as somebody who was in the press and working that day, we didn't do such a coherent job ourselves all the time that morning.
No, it was. I remember this well for a number of reasons. I had just put my wife on a plane that morning at 9 o'clock, an American Airlines flight out of Dulles, and it wasn't until 3 o'clock that afternoon that I knew that she was not on the flight that went into the Pentagon. So it was confusing for all of us. The amount of misinformation that was going around in all of our parts was just enormous.
Let's get a caller involved in the conversation. Eric is with us from Monterey, California.
Hello.
Hi.
Actually, I have two comments. I'm an Air Force officer, and I've worked extensively with pilots. First, that the events of September 11th were truly paradigm-shaking. That nobody had ever seen anything like this. Nobody had prepared for it. Nobody had even trained for an event like this. And I have a hard time believing, knowing several pilots myself, that any of them were ready to shoot down a civilian airliner under these circumstances. Even giving the vice president's order, I really do have a hard time believing that this was something that we were prepared to accept as a nation.
Darrell Jenkins, you're on the civil aviation side, but I wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
Really, a tad out of my expertise, what the military will or will not do. It's an interesting point, though, and certainly on the part of a pilot of a military plane shooting down a civilian aircraft within your own country's borders would have been a very, very difficult decision that day.
Would, this is another impossible thing to know, but obviously you talk about the commercial airline pilots of the planes that were hijacked. How would they have responded to news that Air Force planes were up there weapons-free?
Oh, well, that would have been interesting as well. The training in a hijacking situation is very specific, and the training is that you are to be passive, and the reason why is in 90-plus percent of the situations where there had been hijackings and the pilots were passive, everybody got down to the ground and they got off safe and free. And so this was just totally different against anything that we'd ever trained for, anything that we really anticipated ever happening. So this went against all of our training.
Eric, thank you. Good question.
Thank you.
Darrell Jenkins, just before we go, have these procedures been improved and changed? Obviously, the Transport Safety Administration is involved in a lot of this now.
Well, certainly a lot has changed since then. The thing that is scary still is the airport security. The problem is the machine-human interface. So you have all of the screening that goes on, and that's kind of the backbone of the security system. And the truth is that security screening is boring, it is repetitious, so it is at best chancy.
Darryl Jenkins, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Darryl Jenkins, a professor at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach, Florida, joining us by phone from his home in Fauquier County, Virginia. NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, also came in for some criticism today. Joining now to discuss its role is Mike Perini, Director of Public Affairs for NORAD. He's a retired colonel and joins us by phone from Reagan National Airport here in Washington, D.C. Thanks very much.
Thank you for the opportunity to discuss this.
As you looked at the report's conclusions about the what happened at NORAD that day, what do you come away with?
Well, we at NORAD shall never forget those who lost their lives and who were injured during the attacks on September 11th. And we must say the work that the commission did to go through the thousands of pages of notes in the hearings, I think they've done a great job.
And in that respect, the report concludes that NORAD was completely unprepared for this event and hadn't trained for it. Is that accurate?
Well, you have to remember, pre-9/11, NORAD, which had been around for 45 years, was focused and did a great job in looking at external threats to our nation. It was, you know, developed during the Cold War, and it worked very, very well. But since then, and on that day, as you have noted and your callers have noted, there was a lot of work to deal with a situation that had not been dealt with before. And a lot of changes have been made since then. A lot of great work has been done, and the skies are much safer as a result today.
According to the report, NORAD officials maintain that they would have been able to intercept and shoot down United 93. That's the last plane to crash, the one that landed in Pennsylvania. The report says they're not so sure that would have happened.
Well, when we've looked at our models and with our procedures in place today, we believe that we would have had the time for the decision makers to notify people, and then times for the crews to carry out the engagement orders.
Even though, as it turns out, they didn't have the right rules of engagement.
Well, back then the rules of engagement were basically to monitor, and, you know, flight follow, and then report where the aircraft went down. The rules of engagement are much more developed now, and much more specific on what we can and can't do.
But that day, they didn't have the authorization to shoot.
On that day, even if they'd had the authorization, because of the amount of time that they were given, they would not have been able to have executed that tough decision.
And an extremely tough decision it would have been. And thank you for your time today. We appreciate it. Mike Perini, a retired colonel, is a director of public affairs for NORAD, and he joined us by phone from Reagan Airport, which is located, of course, just across the river in Washington, D.C. You're listening to NPR's Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. And joining us now is John Pike, director of globalsecurity.org, a security and defense policy group based in Alexandria, Virginia. He joined us by phone from his office. John, good to have you back on the program.
Yeah.
As you look at the reactions, particularly of NORAD and the FAA, does anything in today's report surprise you? What have we learned that's new?
Well, I think that one of the important things that we have learned from the report is that actually NORAD had much less time to respond to the hijacked aircraft than they had testified a year ago. Back at the hearings early last year, it looked like they had 15, 20, 25 minutes to respond to the hijacked aircraft. In fact, when the commission went back and reconstructed the actual timelines, they only had a couple of minutes, and there was just physically no way that they could have done it. A year ago, you would have said, why was NORAD asleep at the switch? They had all of this time, and they didn't do anything. It turned out that they just really didn't have enough time to do anything.
As you then go up the ladder a little bit and look at how the Pentagon responded to all of this and setting up the various conference calls and structures that they needed to do, how does the report address that?
Well, I think that they did a good job under the circumstances, but unfortunately, they were still fumbling. They didn't manage to get Secretary of Defense into the conference calls until sometime after the Trade Centers had been hit. And they really never were able to get the Federal Aviation Administration into the conference calls. First, they had problems with getting secure telephones. Then the FAA official that they got on the line, he was in the conference call, but he was out of the loop at the FAA, so he really didn't know what was going on. As is frequently the case, orders were issued from the top, but they never got out to the people who needed them. The vice president authorized the NORAD to shoot down the incoming airliners. That information, that authorization was never passed to the pilots themselves.
Let's get a caller involved. Betsy's with us from Memphis, Tennessee.
Yes. Hello?
Yes, you're on the air, Betsy. Go ahead.
Okay. I love you can hear me on my cell phone. Yeah, that brings up an interesting question, and I haven't heard all of the news today, but why is Vice President Cheney making decisions rather than the president about shooting down planes, assuming that he was on Air Force One and he could make such decisions if he had to?
Well, exactly where he was and exactly which minute is still not utterly resolved, but in conversations with in the report, John Pike, we appear to hear that Vice President Cheney asks the president to make that decision and then relays the decision.
And then the president made that decision, and Cheney was trying to relay it down the chain of command. Part of the problem, somebody had to make the call to NORAD, and it was Cheney who made the call. I think the problem that Cheney was having was that he was skipping the echelon of Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense. They had to get Rumsfeld back in the chain of command. So they did have the president participating in it, but the vice president was the one who was attempting to carry the message. Unfortunately, that message didn't get all the way down the chain of command.
Betsy, thank you.
Thank you.
John, before we let you go, you've been quoted as saying, if bin Laden had attacked us when Ike was president, it would have met a different response.
Well, it would have met a very different response, because when the Eisenhower administration was running air defense, and back when President Bush was flying air defense fighters back in the 1960s, we had an enormous air defense apparatus, thousands of fighter aircraft, many of them on strip alert, thousands of air defense missiles to shoot down aircraft, and they were locked and loaded. They were cocked and ready to go because the main threat back then was Soviet bombers. Well, when the Soviets got long-range ballistic missiles, we started taking apart our air defense system, and the air defense system that President Bush was presiding over was only a pale shadow of the air defense system that he was part of back in the 1960s.
Indeed, there's an interesting moment where the FAA attempts to contact the ready strip in Atlantic City, New Jersey, to try to get fighters in the air without realizing that strip had been phased out.
Yes, yes.
John Pike, thanks very much.
Thank you.
John Pike is director of globalsecurity.org, a security and defense policy group in Alexandria, Virginia. He joined us by phone from his office. When we come back from a short break, the controversy over Iraq and Al-Qaeda. President Bush insists there is a connection. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.